There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Past, Present, Future. We've reached episode 2 in our new series about the history of freedom with the philosopher and writer Leah Ippi. Today, I'm talking to Leah about ancient ideas of freedom, going back to the beginning, at least in the Western world, to Plato, to Socrates, to the Stoics, to the Christians. What do those ideas of freedom mean to us today? And how, if at all, can they help? Past, Present, Future is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books, and the LRB has got a brand new must-listen podcast out now. It tells the story of the sinking of the General Belgrano, the bloodiest and most controversial military action of the Falklands War, and of a diary written on board the British submarine that fired the torpedoes. Andrew O'Hagan talks to the man who wrote it, the man who leaked it, and the journalists, submariners, civil servants, and politicians who got caught up in the cover-up. The Belgrano Diary, a new 6-part podcast series from the LRB. Listen at lrb.me/Belgrano or wherever you get your podcasts. Leah, we're going to try and do this as a history now, but we're not going to do, I think, all of the great thinkers in order history. We'll try and do it chronologically. I think histories probably work best when they're chronological. And we're going to start in a relatively familiar place for histories of Western philosophy anyway, which is with Plato and with Socrates. It's not because it all has to start there, or this is the foundation of everything, but because I think the ancient world is so distant from us in so many ways, and many of the things that we're talking about don't actually fit our categories of freedom at all. But you can hear the echoes, and occasionally it's almost spooky. You feel parts of the ancient world in the modern world in often quite surprising ways. We can't keep explaining how and why maybe this conversation is anachronistic and Plato wouldn't have the first idea what we were talking about. We're just going to have to jump in. And let's do it through Socrates. Plato, Socrates, whichever, but Socrates is the character here. And Socrates can embody an ideal of freedom in two ways. One, because of the arguments that he made, and we'll come on to those arguments. He has things to say, often not actually in the language of freedom, but have certainly seemed to many people like an account of what it would be to be a human being living to your full liberated potential. But also because Socrates embodied a certain way of approaching the problem, which was to keep asking questions. And so that's another way you might think about what it means to be free, which is not what arguments you wind up with, but the quest and the Socratic dialogue, which is an ugly term for something that's pretty familiar to people, which is just talking about it, but talking about it through questioning each answer with another question, is itself a model of freedom. You're a philosopher. Does that speak to you as a model of freedom when you think about maybe what it means to be free in the fundamental human way we talked about a bit last time, that actually it just is the business of asking a question of each answer that you get?
Yeah, that's a really good way to start with this question, because I'd say the answer is yes and no. And it's true that asking a question and giving an answer is in some ways paradigmatic of freedom. But there is also something else that Socrates does. It's not just that he's thinking about, okay, I'm giving you a question, you're giving an answer. There is something further to the Socratic dialogue, which is about there is a right and a wrong answer. And there is a kind of ideal. And there is an answer about every single question that we ask. It's just we may not know it yet, and we may have to come to an understanding, and we have to perhaps inquire further on where we're coming from and so on. But I think just saying that the Socratic notion of freedom is just giving question and answer, I think it doesn't do justice to the Socratic model, because it also doesn't really take seriously what Socrates was responding to, which is the sophists. And that's what the sophists were also already doing.
And they were never stopping, right? That was the point. Socrates thinks at a certain point you've reached your answer.
But also, I think it's more that there was a kind of relativism about the sophists that Socrates was objecting to. And so while both of them embrace this idea of dialogue and conversation and philosophy as a vehicle to some sort of self-awareness, the sophists were prepared to be relativistic about the answer in a way in which Socrates wasn't. Socrates was insisting, no, there is actually a truth. And Plato further articulates what that means and how it needs to be unpacked and so on. But the sense that there is a difference between what we might call knowledge and opinion. So, you know, any one of us has an opinion on everything, but we don't necessarily have knowledge. And Socrates really insists on this difference between knowledge and opinion. And it's central to the Socratic dialogue and to the way in which these conversations unfold that there is this answer that is premised on that difference between opinion and knowledge. And I think it's really important also because, yes, I agree with you that there is something about freedom which is about disruption. And Socrates was a very disruptive character. He was already very disruptive in his appearances. If you think about the ideas of Greek bodies and Greek beauty and the Greek citizen and the polis and so on, Socrates was none of that. The way he looked, he was always depicted as being very ugly, and he had this kind of large nose, long hair, slightly disheveled, wore the same clothes to go to sleep and then woke up, just didn't care about the way he looked.
Which is not unknown among philosophers then or now. I mean, Sartre is the classic 20th century version of that.
But there is a sense in which the Greek model of how you ought to be, in some ways, this is also kind of like in our societies, where there is a sense of how you appear and how you behave, and there is a notion of what's proper and improper, and there are social norms and social conventions. And Socrates, the way you just looked at him, he was not that. He was not the Greek body, and he was not, you know, the Greek sculpture, and he made no pretense to be that. He didn't pretend to be something that he wasn't. And in fact, this is also why he had this pull on the, let's call it the dissidents in the polis, in the city, on the young. And some people will know that one of the charges that Socrates gets when he gets trialed by the Greeks is that he was corrupting the young and he was teaching gods that were different from the gods that were already in the city. And that's all to do with the fact that he was a challenger of convention. And maybe there is something about the Socratic attitude, which is about, you know, maybe he was one of the first dissidents. And there is something to that attitude, which is about freedom as disruption. So he didn't necessarily, I don't think Socrates spoke of freedom very much as such, as a concept. And nor did Plato that much. They were interested in justice and other things. But freedom as a concept isn't necessarily particularly central. But there is something about the free spirit and the free attitude and the free inquiry that is part of what Socrates was after. And that also is why he's so important to us and to philosophy.
And these things pull in different directions. So Socrates, the dissident, they're not using the language of freedom, but you can see, you can extract from them, Plato, Socrates, and from some of these ideals, a version of freedom that speaks to us, and the dissident is one. Like I said, you know, Sartre, the French are on the whole often, you know, concerned with how things look. Sartre wasn't. And that's the 20th century version of the same thing. And the glamorous are drawn to it. So like with Socrates, surrounded by good-looking young men, or in Sartre's case, women, we can completely recognize it. And yet, it's incredibly challenging to a modern sensibility, maybe to my sensibility, to go back to our last conversation, the idea that actually, if you're serious about, among other things, freedom, you have to believe in the truth. And you have to believe that truth and opinion are very, very different things, because there is a version of the modern conception of freedom, which it is freedom of opinion. It doesn't matter if what you believe is true or not. You've got to be able to say it. You've got to be unconstrained in how you say it. You mustn't have other human beings telling you that you're wrong. And all of those very modern ideas. And this pushes incredibly hard against that. Do you think, you personally, as a philosopher or as a human being, do you think that absent a belief in truth, it's not really possible to be free?
Well, it depends on what we mean by truth. And I don't think Socrates, and there's a difference here between Socrates and Plato, and that difference may be important to this conversation, actually. I don't think Socrates had the truth that he wanted to convince people of. He wanted to convince them to suspend what is on the surface, the truths that they take for granted. So when we articulate our opinions, we actually believe in them, and we often articulate them as truths. So behind every opinion is a person's conviction that what they are saying is true, because otherwise, why would you make a claim to validity or to plausibility? Or everything we say, we are convinced of it.
Really? I'm not sure that's true of me. I think often it's because you are fulfilling a social convention, which is that's how conversation goes, opinion and opinion. But when pushed, you wouldn't defend it.
No, hang on. I think we have grounds for holding different opinions, right? So why are we holding this opinion rather than the opposite?
Because it works in this context. This is the relativism, right? This is the, I'll take it so far, but then if you really push me, I'll be full of doubt about it.
I don't think so. I think this is what the sophists were doing.
So I see where I'm being pushed in this conversation.
So, and it was very important in the context of democratic Athens, just as it is really important in our context. And this is also a way in which, for all the differences, Socrates is also our contemporary, and these discussions are really important now, regardless of all the contextual nuances. Because a part of the Socratic move and of the Socratic revolution of the mind, if we want to call it a revolution, is exactly that he was pushing against this idea in democratic Athens that, you know, all citizens have opinions, they just voice their opinions. And then it was really important in the assembly that they had that capacity. And this is actually what distinguished Athens from alternative regimes, like, say, Sparta or whatever. So it was fundamental to Athenian democracy that citizens had opinions, that they would come to the assembly and voice those opinions, and that rules and decisions would be adopted on the basis of conversations in the agora. And the sophists were the kinds of people who would go around for money telling people and teaching them how to make arguments more effective, which is not that different from, I don't know, if you think about contemporary training of politicians or leaders or the importance of comms. You usually pay some person or firm or company who'd come and teach you how to make a good argument and how to pitch your party and how to respond to the media and all this kind of stuff. So that's, to me, very similar to sophistry and to what the sophists were doing, which was to get money for, didn't matter what the sophists themselves thought. They were just training people to be more effective at articulating whatever opinion they held on whatever grounds they held that opinion, for whatever reason, the reason didn't matter. And Socrates starts to challenge that by saying, first of all, he always refused to be paid. So he wouldn't go, and people said, okay, let's pay Socrates. And he'd say, no, this is not, philosophy is not for sale. And because he thought there's something about the critical spirit that is about self-knowledge and encouraging self-knowledge and education. None of these things could be commodified, let's put it that way, this kind of modern word, but in a way in which the sophists did. And so he stood for a model of something different from way of relating to your opinions and querying your opinions and interrogating yourself that was very different to what the sophists were doing. And that, in fact, was the opposite of what people think when they think, well, he had, or someone who has a kind of Platonic Socratic attitude, has a truth that they want to convince other people of. Socrates did the opposite. Socrates said, I am the one who knows least of all. But actually, it turns out that I am the most knowledgeable of all because I am the one who knows that their opinions shouldn't be always taken for granted, and that I'm always the one who is querying myself and interrogating and putting pressure on my arguments, where all my adversaries, they just take convention for granted or take some source of authority or other. I'm the one who is really challenging authority here. And I'm not telling you what you should think, but I'm telling you that you should know yourself better and you should know the reasons for why you're upholding these different opinions. And that was really, I think, what's distinctive of the Socratic method and why it's so important.
But does it rest on an assumption that you are striving towards something, that there is something out there? Because again, in modern settings, it's not always clear to me that that is a shared view, that a lot of this is self-referential, internal. So there's the questioning of the self, and there's the thing that you won't take your own assumptions for granted. But there's got to be something out there for the, like you say, for the Socratic method to work. You've got to believe that you're getting closer to the truth.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important to the Socratic method and to that way of thinking that there is a difference between knowledge and opinion. Now, how you get to knowledge, to true knowledge, and the roots, the communication, the mechanisms, how we engage each other, these are different. And then, in a way, the whole of philosophy is about trying to understand that. But yes, that there is a difference between knowledge and opinion, I think, is important. And that also there is a notion of some things are not just relative and we can come to an understanding of what is not relative. That's also important. But I also think it's right. I mean, we do now think that there are things that are just wrong in our society. So we wouldn't say if someone says, oh, slavery is fine, well, oh, that's all right. That's their opinion. They can say that. We tend to think, well, that's a wrong opinion. And we do often make arguments that are based on this distinction between warranted opinion and unwarranted opinion, let's call it that. And then maybe knowledge is something that builds and develops on warranted opinions.
But I have this instinctive response to that. It's not a very sophisticated response, but Plato thought slavery was fine. So Plato is both the person. So I know with Plato, Socrates, but I'm talking about Plato here. Plato thought it was fine in a society that thought it was, on the whole, natural. And yet this is our model for the belief that not all truths are relative. But they were really wrong about that. And part of that makes me feel that there is something relative going on here, that the people who were both our models for the seekers after the truth were so wrong.
Because I think there is a way in which they are contingently wrong about contingent things, but not necessarily wrong about the method of coming to an understanding of what's right and what's wrong. And I think with most philosophers, this is the case of the past, right? So most of them were in favor of slavery, or they were sexist, or they were racist, or, you know, any model that we pick as a model of, from, you know, from Plato to Kant to John Stuart Mill to whatever, we'll find some elements in those writings that will tell us that these people didn't always stand up to what they were teaching. But in a way, that's contingent. There are things that we also take from their teachings and from their philosophical work that has a relevance. And that relevance is still instructive for us now, regardless of then other details of their thought. I think, going back to the question of what makes Socrates distinctive, which is this idea of dissidence and questioning convention, questioning authority, the instinct behind that is really important. And it's just as important now as it was in the times of Socrates. And I also think that what he was responding to, which is this tendency among the sophists or among the ruling elites in democratic Athens to just say, well, opinions, democracy is premised on the exchange of opinions, and there's no way of saying who's right and who's wrong, and so we just make decisions. That can't be the case, that we need to actually discuss further and come to an understanding of where are these opinions rooted and where do they come from and how do they connect to then what Plato would go on to complement with ideas of the good or of the just or whatever.
So if he was sitting here now and I said to him, why couldn't you even get close to seeing, using your method, that slavery was wrong? You didn't seem to have any way into that question. And would he say back to me, well, that's because you have the advantages of, what, another 2,000 years of people questioning and questioning and questioning? And I can see it now. I can completely see that that was our mistake and we should have been questioned more. It just seems like such a...
There are things we know that people who lived in different eras didn't know. So if people thought that you are created unequal and you didn't have a story of how you were created and you didn't have science behind it and you didn't have general knowledge, then that obviously plays a really important role. Where I'm born, which family I'm born, which state I'm born into. If I don't have a story about human beings coming, being evolved and coming from certain features and developing into certain other features, that's a whole scientific theory that then feeds into a knowledge of humans that's very different from the knowledge that these authors had.
So that's scientific knowledge. So most people, again, in the modern world would think that's not philosophical knowledge. That's scientific knowledge. In pre-modern and even early modern settings, that distinction didn't hold. Scientific knowledge and philosophical knowledge were similar. Is it that this quest after a never fully known but potentially knowable truth has moved from philosophy to science?
I don't know in what position I am here, whether I'm in a minority or in a majority. I think there is a lot of philosophy to contemporary science as well. So I think in general, this distinction between philosophy and science is just as such is a little bit crude. And I think our scientific paradigms are grounded on certain philosophical assumptions and our, in turn, philosophical theories are developed on the basis of what we know from science. So I wouldn't say that there is a sharp boundary still now between the two. I mean, of course, there is a realm in which philosophy now makes claims is narrower than what it was in the past when we didn't know certain things about the universe and so on. But in more generally, I think the relation between the two is similar because I think there is something to science, as I say, that's grounded on philosophical assumptions.
Something else that's distinctive about the Socratic method is it requires an individual philosopher. Socrates is a unique character for the reasons you described, being willing to question his, it was always his in that setting, doesn't always have to be, his own beliefs. There's something not remotely solipsistic about it, but there's something deeply personal about it. It has to be an individual human being conscious of their own individuality. And it's a public thing. It's a collective thing in that you do it with other people. I don't think you can do it on your own. Certainly the way it's described there, he's not setting his own questions and answering his own questions. He needs them partly as foils, sometimes to make fun of them, but also to push him on. So it is a public thing. It happens among other people. And various modern versions of the pursuit of the truth are quite distant from that. There are also lots that aren't. And a university is still a place in which you think that people exchange ideas collectively. But that version of it, the doing it among other people bit, and if this is in any way about freedom, this is freedom in a joint setting. I mean, collective is probably the wrong word for it, but joint. It needs other people. There are lots of modern versions of that where it doesn't. You follow your thoughts and you can question yourself. You can be brutal and ruthlessly self-questioning, but it doesn't require other people. I'm taking from what you said that you think it does require other people.
I also think that in every time and in every society, our understanding as individuals is always based on our relations to other people. So it's not possible. We don't actually have solipsism ever. I mean, it's very rare.
So even if you go off to your room and because you're writing your great novel about freedom or whatever it is, and it is really you interrogating your own thoughts, what you're actually doing is ventriloquizing other people.
Yeah, and your thoughts are always the product of other social relations. So you can never have thoughts in a vacuum. I mean, of course, there is something about Socrates, which is that it takes this sharp form of dissidence that it takes, that is in part also the product of democratic Athens and of the Athens of Pericles, where citizens are empowered. As we said, that's a very restrictive understanding of citizenship, is because it's usually just free males and property owners and so on. But it is still empowering for people understood even in this restrictive way. And that's why we have character of Socrates that emerges in that context, that then takes that to a radical form and becomes a quintessential dissident. And so in that sense, yes, I think there is something about the politics of Athens that produces this. And it may be that in general, these very sharply dissident figures emerge in particular historical circumstances that are connected to where their societies are at. But I also think that more generally, all of us as individuals, all our thoughts, all our writings, everything we produce is connected to a social setting and comes. And if anything, I'd say that the flaw of our liberal society is that we are often not aware of the deep ways in which we are pervaded by others, by the presence of others, by the presence of thought that was there before us and that will outlive us. And we just tend to think that it's just us and our thoughts. But I don't think that's the case. That's, yeah, seems to me it's a very restrictive way of understanding also the modern predicament.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The paradox of the relationship to democracy is this is a quintessential product of democracy, this kind of dissidence. And to be a dissident in a democratic society for Socrates was to make the arguments against democracy. And Plato's arguments against democracy do, as I understand them, also include the idea that democracy settles too easily for easy answers to difficult questions. And it's a kind of pandering form of politics. It's not looking for the hard answers. It's looking to settle on the answers that will work for now, including to the biggest question. So in the Republic, one of the arguments is that what you get in a democracy is people claiming to answer questions like, so this isn't one of them, but it could easily be, what is freedom? So think of contemporary democracy. Contemporary democratic politicians are always telling people that there is a shared answer to the question, what is freedom? And so we can then say that this is good because it will make you freer. This policy, this way of organizing our society, of deciding who belongs, who doesn't belong, of organizing our economy is conducive to freedom. And the trouble with democracy is that it allows those big questions to be answered very quickly. And the test of the answer is whether it will hold for now. So you'll take a word like freedom, you'll tell people it's freedom because you have license. That would be a classic sort of Platonic version of this, because license is not freedom. License is a kind of indulgence. But you can, in a democracy, tell people that license is freedom, and it will hold long enough for your purposes, which is presumably to exercise some form of power. So this is a really radical critique of democracy. And it's not, though ancient democracy was so different from ours in so many ways, mysteriously different from ours, it still holds in the sense that you can still feel its bite, its force. That the trouble with democracy is that it encourages politicians and citizens to look to the answer to these questions that will do for now. And yet, I think there are many things to be said for democracy, but on that account, this is a deal breaker.
I think there's so many interesting things about that, both the overlaps and what we learn and how the story is both good and bad in a way. I was thinking, and I wanted to say something about, go back to Socrates and connect it to the story of how Socrates is in some ways the product of democratic Athens. But I think it's the end of Socrates is also really telling about democracy, because Socrates gets killed by his fellow citizens. So in this society that is supposed to be the one where freedom of opinion flourishes, where all citizens have equal views and where all views are respected, the one who is the fundamental dissident, who doesn't say to them, don't respect the laws of the city, it just says, ask yourself where these laws are coming from and what is their foundation, is the one that is executed. And the trial of Socrates is so interesting because it shows you how he's the result of democracy, but also in a way what the limit of democracy is, which is that it panders to the common sense, and whoever departs from then this common sense is at risk of, you know, is not going to be killed, but will be considered a fool, or will be considered someone who is not to be taken seriously, or be ridiculed, or will be in a position of minority one way or another. So I think what Socrates was saying about democratic Athens was, yes, you have to listen to each other, but you have to also make good arguments. And good arguments aren't just the arguments that are rhetorically persuasive and powerful, which is often the case now. We're driven by rhetoric. Our politics is driven by rhetoric. It's not really driven by the pursuit of truth, of real values, in a way. There's a lot of talk about values, but I don't think it's taken seriously. And I think he was saying, look, fellow Athenians, it's all good to have democracy, but our opinions need to be scrutinized further and needs to be critically examined. And at some point, he has this sentence where he says the unexamined life is not worth living. So it's telling both in the way in which democracy generates a Socrates-like figure, a dissident, but also in the way in which that dissident features and the fortune of the dissident is unmade by democracy in a way. Socrates is not a hero. He's a philosophical hero. But politically, it's complete catastrophe the way it goes. And it's also, I think, a tale of what perpetual dissident will have politically, or the fortunes of the perpetual dissident politically, I think, it's very interesting what the Socratic story tells us about that.
Isn't the criticism, though, it's not just that democracy panders to common sense. I mean, you shouldn't pander on the whole. But common sense is okay. The problem is dressing it up as though it was the truth. And democracies have a tendency to do this. They inflate their talk about values because that's the way you sell them. I mean, the way in which you sell your version of it. And this goes back to what you were saying earlier, that behind the opinion is our belief that it's the truth. A more cynical view is behind the opinion is a knowledge that it's not the truth, but you know it's much easier to sell if you come across as believing it. If you can fake sincerity in democracy, you've got it made. That's the democratic method. It's a really radical critique. And it suggests to me that actually what you need in democracy, and this is the opposite of what you said earlier, is a bit more relativism. That is a bit more awareness that these are, on the whole, inflated claims. That what democracy really is an understanding that different people's point of view, however passionately held, is profoundly contingent. And that's the thing that in democracies we tend to lose sight of because we get so carried away, and also because the route to power is to come across as someone with certainty. I can think of so many contemporary examples. So there's the example of Tony Blair in the Iraq War, where he knew that if he really learnt the truth about how messy and complicated it was going to be, it would be much harder to sell it. So he deliberately, there's a lot of accounts of this that suggest this was a deliberate policy. He deliberately insulated himself from, quote unquote, the truth in order to come across as more sincere. And that, you know, you can criticize him for it, but that seems to me a quintessential democratic move. And therefore, what we need is less sort of Socratic seeking after the truth and just more self-awareness that if we're going to live in a democracy, we mustn't inflate these claims.
Okay, but then here is the criticism of democracy, which is actually the criticism that both Socrates and Plato articulate of exactly that ideal, because they said, so this is what's happening in 5th century Athenian democracy and in this world where the sophists are paid to teach people to make whatever arguments, acknowledging that this is all relative and anyone's answer is as good as anyone else. And then Plato says, well, in the Republic, in the voice of Socrates, then democracy becomes a kind of constitutional bazaar. So people are there and anything goes. And then someone will emerge that will tell the masses, okay, now I'm now going to help you make sense of this. So instead of the philosopher, you have the demagogue and the populist leader who will then come and say what you truly want, what you really, because there is a sense in which people actually, you say to them, well, it's all relative, but it's not true. It's part of our urge, of our insight, of our instinct is to long for authenticity and we have a desire for truth. And you can't be satisfied with just being told that, you know, it's all relative. But for a start, because it isn't. I mean, there are many realms of life in which we operate not on the basis of everything is relative. We have rules and we think those rules have justifications and we don't think those justifications are there just because someone convinced us of that justification. We think they are there because there is a good reason behind that justification. So I think Socrates in the Republic says at some point, okay, fine, we can go along with the story of it's all relative. Anyone says what they want and the sophists are being given money. And but for a start, the people who pay more money will be heard more and so on. So that just even leaving that aside, which also has parallels with our contemporary world in terms of influence and ability to articulate and have voice and so on. But even leaving all of that aside, there will be someone at some point, some leader who will come out and tell the masses, okay, what you really want, what you really need, and will help them articulate their grievances in such a way that will then empower that individual for no particular reason other than just he happens to be the one that the masses listen to at that point. And that will be how democracy descends in tyranny. I mean, it's not that I don't think Plato and Socrates wanted to criticize democracy. It was more the connection between democracy and tyranny that made them so concerned about democracy. And I think maybe there is a version of democracy where that doesn't have to happen, which is the one where, and indeed the one that Plato was trying to articulate, where philosophers have more of a role in understanding and helping articulate these claims in the public sphere and where knowledge plays more of a role than opinion.
There's a contemporary version of that argument, which I'm going to do in the shortest shorthand possible, but you hear it, which is you let postmodernism infect American universities and you'll get Trump. That there's a line that runs from the first to the second, which exactly matches what you've just described. And I'm not saying that that's true. I don't think it is true. I think it's more complicated than that. But certainly there are people who believe it, right? The relativization of American life, particularly intellectual life and public discourse, is what opens the grounds for a demagogue. But on the other hand, I think it's also true, to go back to what I was saying before, that in the absence of at least some skepticism about democratic claims, truth claims, you get a bastardized version of democratic politics too.
This is exactly why it's so important to distinguish between knowledge and opinion. And this is why holding on to the search for truth is so important, because that's exactly on that basis that you can then say, okay, let's try and all find out what the truth is here, and let's make it more complicated, let's be a bit more nuanced, let's try and open up the conversation. And that's where the role of what Socrates was, the role of a philosopher, or, you know, might say scientific experts or whatever, or just general education in democratic societies like ours, where it's not necessarily about having a Socrates character, because fortunately we've moved away from this idea that there are individuals that can enlighten us, and we think there are institutions and education and processes and procedures through which we can come to this understanding. But I think it is important that we hold on to this difference, and that we do think that truth is important and that it's not anything goes.
One more question about democracy. So then, is the problem with democracy that it thinks of this too much as, in our modern sense, a political project? That is, this is the bazaar of contested opinions in which you arrive at a version of the truth through the outcomes of certain procedures and methods and elections and so on, collective decision-making of various different kinds. So you're talking about, say, a democratic education, which might be closer to a Socratic version of this, and a democratic education at a deep level, and I'm sure you would use this word, is political. But it's not what most of us mean by democracy, which is political in a very different way. It's a way of taking all the different things that people think and producing outcomes that will last for 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, and I think maybe that's because we are at a contemporary stance, and the one that I'm trying to resist in what I'm saying with this notion of democratic education and this Socratic model reworked for the contemporary world is that it's ethics connected to politics. Well, there is a politics that is completely devoid of ethics, but it leads to horrible results. At the very fundamental level, it's really important that there is moral constraint on politics. And then the question is, okay, what are the moral constraints? How do we get to these moral constraints? What kind of institutions can help us elaborate those moral constraints? But we can't say the political helps us find the moral. It has to go both ways. And in fact, there's this really interesting paragraph in The Republic, again, where Socrates is talking to Thrasymachus about what is justice. And Thrasymachus says, justice is just the rule of the stronger. It's just the powerful. They make the rules. They decide, you know, they win the wars in that case. They decide what kind of constitution you will have. The constitution will make the norms. The norms will decide how people should conduct themselves in their daily lives. So you have laws. And so what is justice? It's positive law. Fundamentally, it's the rule of the stronger. And Socrates is really resisting that and saying, well, justice can't just be convention. It can't just be what society is telling you, what authority is telling you. And it has to be something deeper about our sense of reason and the good and all the other things that come up in the Republic. But at this kind of more superficial level, it really is about the difference between justice as a result of convention and justice as something connected to an ethical project. I think it's really important, and I don't know if I'm in a minority, and this is really contrary to the kind of modern spirit, but I think it's really important to recover that notion of rooting the political and the concept of right to this notion of the ethical.
You said when we started this that this isn't in the bits of writing that we're talking about here, often framed in the language of freedom, and yet as you describe it, it's demanding, it's super demanding, but you can see how maybe it would be a way of explaining why some of the frustrations with democratic freedom require a deeper look at what lies behind them. But it is really demanding. Last time we talked very, very briefly, you mentioned in relation to your grandmother about Stoicism, which is another super demanding version of freedom. But weirdly, what you've just described, I think for most moderns, 21st century people, is it's quite alien to how people think. The weird thing about Stoicism, and I'm just picking some random classical ideas of freedom here. The weird thing about Stoicism is it has a real contemporary vogue. So not in the way that your grandmother talked about it, because she'd lived a life where she really could say, you know, I've experienced all of the different ways in which a human being can feel they've lost their freedom, and yet here I am, I'm still a self-possessed human being. But it's almost a form of therapy speak, Stoicism, which is if you can acquire a certain relationship to your own emotions, feelings, thoughts, desires, you will be liberated from them. The classical version is much more demanding than that. I just want to read you one passage. So we're leaping across time and space here, but this is Seneca. For Seneca, Stoicism is about not succumbing to the temptations of pleasure, among other things. So Seneca says, surrendering to pleasure means also surrendering to pain, surrendering to toil, surrendering to poverty. Both ambition and anger will wish to have the same rights over me as pleasure, and I shall be torn asunder, or rather pulled to pieces. And then he says, what is freedom, you ask? It means not being a slave to any circumstance, to any constraint, to any chance. It means compelling fortune to enter the lists on equal terms. And on the day when I know that I have the upper hand, her power will be naught. When I have death in my own control, to go back to what we talked about last time, the first question, shall I take orders from her? So Stoicism, here's another super demanding version of freedom, which has probably been diluted in the modern retelling. So it becomes a resource to relieve you from some of the stresses and anxieties that I want to be relieved from. I sometimes think if I could be a bit more stoical, it would be better. But this is the super demanding version of it. And it requires being liberated, not just from the bad stuff, but from the good stuff too. And it also requires really having death front and center. So here's another one, which I get the connection from then to now, ancient to modern. And yet when it's put in these terms, for moderns, it's almost impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it as demanding, but also not very demanding in a way. So I think it's demanding because it's asking of us to suspend certain things that we usually think we care about.
Like not wanting to die.
In that sense, it is. But in another way, it's also like self-help. It's not asking you to change the world. It's asking you to just change yourself in the face of a world that seems unchangeable. And in fact, I think this is where the connection is between Socrates and the Stoics. Socrates is tragic, but it's still hopeful because there is still a sense in which this is a project for the community. And I think the transition from that to the more the Hellenistic period is that somehow there is this giving up on the community and it becomes a project of the person who disengages from the community. And this is where also the connection between the Stoics and the Cynics, for example, is where you start with this idea of, I don't care about convention. This is all rubbish. It's all an illusion. The world is bad and so on. So I might as well just try and find ways of relieving myself and releasing myself from that and from the burdens of the world. If I just go back to Socrates for a minute and then back to the Stoics, the Socratic ideal is, it's not demanding when it's critical. It's demanding when Socrates is asked to articulate, which he never does, and Platonists never do, and generally people who think like them, it's struggle to do, is to articulate, okay, what is the right society? You're teaching me that this is not the right society. What is the right society? And that seems very demanding. But I don't think it's demanding in the sense in which Socrates urges his interlocutors to just be critical. Don't accept this. Don't take it seriously and continue to kind of voice your criticism and to try and change things, to operate, to influence the youth and think about education and so on. Now, you get this transition from Socrates to the Stoics when even that is no longer possible. You have a sense of a world that is in crisis, in fragments, and it's a very different period, Hellenistic period, from the one in which Socrates was operating. And then you have this, the only possible way out seems to be the individual extrication from the evils of the world. And yeah, it's demanding in one way, but it's not demanding in that you don't have to do anything with other people. It's just you by yourself, and then training yourself and helping yourself and controlling yourself. And at most, you set the example, but you don't really have a big obligation to come up with solidarity or create structures of relational engagement. Or yeah. So I think in some ways, it is demanding, but in another way, it's also defeatist.
The problem I have with it is the thing that you said last time, which is there's a version of it which says, yeah, you can be free even if you're a slave, because all of it's the same, right? It's all chance, it's all fortune, we're all going to die in the end. And in our different ways, we can all come to a mastery over that by sort of not caring about it. It's more than that, but that's at the heart of it. And yet, so I don't know, I've never been a slave, but it doesn't seem to me a persuasive argument for a slave who would say, actually, I don't think that's what freedom is. I think freedom is emancipation. And that actually that line from Seneca, which is, we will be liberated from indifferent to circumstance. You can only really make that argument in a very particular set of circumstances. Like, you have to be someone like Seneca, the most famous of the Stoics is Marcus Aurelius, who happened to be emperor. You know, like, it's a sort of emperor's philosophy. You can, from a certain position of, for want of a better word, privilege, think that circumstance doesn't matter. And then you can generalize that to say, this is available to everybody. This is available to slaves. Actually, maybe this, if I was a slave, maybe that would be a great philosophy to have because that's a really shitty circumstance. So it'd be great to think that that doesn't matter. But actually, to be indifferent to pleasure and pain is something that is only possible, for instance, if you're not poor or if you're not enslaved or if you're not oppressed. And therefore, this thing doesn't make sense as a political philosophy. It's completely self-defeating.
I guess you can see it both ways. So there's a part of it that is resignation. And so it's teaching you to just cope with the circumstances. And in that sense, even if you're a victim, like my grandmother was a victim for many, many years. And I think having this attitude is what enabled her to survive in circumstances where otherwise you might really struggle. And she survived because she thought, well, I'm always free. I can rise above the circumstances. They can take my... She came from this aristocratic family and was expropriated and her husband was in prison. Most of her relatives were either in a different country or had committed suicide and died in Albania. And she had this extreme inner strength that made hers, and which she articulated by saying, well, you know, they could take away anything from me, they won't take away my dignity. And that made her resilient. So it made her survive and cope with the circumstances and be there for when there was in the world more change collectively, such that then you could still see that happening. So there is a part of it that's, as I say, is resignation. There is a part of it that is resilience. And then how you think about those two will depend on actually factors that not just an individual person can control, but that will depend also more generally on what happens in society. So the problem I have with Stoicism is that I think this notion of the sage or the philosopher or the person who is in control of their fate, it seems to me very individualistic. And you don't just own yourself. Other people own you as well. You have responsibilities to other people. And I remember when I was reading a few months ago Kant's argument against the Stoic argument for suicide. And Kant had this line where he was saying, well, what makes you think that you're in control of your life? There's other people that have claims on your life. So this sense that it's just you and your desires and your wishes and how you think about extricating yourself from the world, well, it's just very selfish. And there is something about the human being which isn't just what the individual wants and likes. And I mean, this is a crude now rendition of the Stoic, and I think there are maybe more sophisticated versions. But on this particular example of suicide, I completely agreed with him and thought, yeah, this is right. You know, it's very indulgent. It looks like it's a quintessentially heroic thing to do, but actually it's a very resigned way of operating and not heroic at all.
I completely get how it works as a support for a life like your grandmother's life, which is a life of profound dramatic change, containing within it the possibility of more change. Doesn't work for a slave, because the life of a slave does not contain any of that. You might be freed if you were lucky, but there is, at least potentially in slavery, the complete absence of the possibility of change. I may be extrapolating from experiences I can't understand. Doesn't make sense to me. And part of the evidence for that is that the philosophy that then becomes the philosophy of freedom for slaves, which is an inversion of almost all the things that we've been talking about, is Christianity, because Christianity becomes the philosophy of freedom as salvation, as love. You know, these are not ideas that fit into the philosophies we've just been talking about, I don't think. Salvation, love, service, community service. So not the communal quest for the truth, but in love of your fellow man. And it is what Nietzsche called the slave revolt in morality. This is freedom for the profoundly unfree. And it's also the basis of the modern world. I mean, the modern world is both based on, in some sense, ancient Greek philosophy. You can hear echoes of it in our world, and you can hear people striving for the things that the ancient Greeks were striving for, that version of personal emancipation or liberation through thought and knowledge and so on, or acceptance of circumstance. And this is also a Christian and a post-Christian world, the Western world. And it's built on the idea of freedom as liberation. And if not in this life, then the next life. There is a thing that you will pass through that will make you free. And in the meantime, what you should do is find freedom in love. And Nietzsche thought that was the basis of democracy. He didn't think the basis of democracy was anything that came from Plato or Socrates. He thought modern democracy was a watered-down version of Christian love. And that's why, in the end, it was hopeless.
Yeah, I think I have a much more charitable reading of Christianity and maybe also a more political one.
I was channeling Nietzsche there. Don't say than me.
But I think also a more political one in a way, in that I think the Christian message is really important at that stage, in part because exactly this is a world of status hierarchies that seem deeply ingrained, and this message that, you know, you are all free. And
genuinely, this is a universal possibility, right? Anyone can find freedom and salvation.
Exactly. So I think that's a really important and empowering message. And I think, yes, you know, there is the whole narrative of this is the afterlife and so on. But then there are philosophical articulations of what the afterlife means, where I think there is a message of Christianity, or indeed any religion which has this sense of the afterlife and this message of redemption through faith and through community, that is, I think, really important when you're thinking about action and moving beyond this individualist paradigm of the Stoics into something more robust and also more meaningful for free. Now, for Christians, this was the afterworld and the afterlife. But I think the sense of the future, and the future that is populated by many people who become somehow in control of their fate and finally free, it's a really important liberating message. And I think I'm channeling here my liberation theology. But I think it's really important. And I just disagree with actually the Nietzschean assessment of Christianity that is just the morality of the slaves. It's the opposite. This is actually a morality that tells the common person in a world that is a world of slavery, that is a world of hierarchy, that is the world of the Roman Empire and so on. Actually, these hierarchies are not important, because there is something to the human predicament that is very, very different from this. And then, you know, we can interpret what Jesus means and the revolutionary hero and all of that. But just at this level, I think, well, I just don't agree.
When I hear you talking about freedom, so I sometimes feel that the thing that I lack that you have, and I think you've just articulated it, is faith. It's almost a religious faith that you have. And you've talked about it today and in the episode that we've already put out. You've talked about the different things that you are striving towards. And sometimes you say, maybe this is a minority opinion, and you know, maybe it is, and I don't know. But I feel like I'm on the other side of something from you on this. And maybe the thing that I'm on the other side of, I'm not sure I agree with Nietzsche either, but the thing that I feel is a certain kind of modern, disabused, disillusioned absence of faith. And maybe people like Nietzsche are to blame for that. I don't know. And so I don't know if I'm a relativist or I'm not a relativist, but I struggle to hold on to what I think your version of the pursuit of freedom requires, which is faith. And it is faith in the future, apart from anything else. It doesn't have to be the afterlife, but it's the thing beyond. I feel like I'm stuck in this world.
Yeah, I have faith. I'll tell you what I have faith. And I think I agree with you. I've also thought a lot about this. And I think, yes, it does come down to a type of faith. I wouldn't call it religious faith. I'd say it's more like a philosophical faith. And there is a difference there, because it's rational. Well, insofar as you can have a faith that is rational, I think this is more a more rational faith than the one that tells you something will happen after you die to you and to your soul and so on. It's really not about the individual. It's not about me. I think my faith is, I guess, more generally a faith in reason and the fact that, yes, human beings all are flawed, and we go back to where we started with Socrates. We have all these temptations and these evils, and there is ideology and there's manipulation and there's propaganda. But fundamentally, in all of us, there is also the capacity to resist all of that, which goes back to having reason and what is freedom as this fundamental sense of what makes us different from animals. And I think what faith is then is holding on to that element of the human and thinking, okay, then this might produce something different from what we have. And being able to hold on to that thought so much that it actually helps you overcome the disasters and the obstacles and the difficulties, and gives you courage in a way to act in a world that is otherwise seems completely not amenable. And that's how I would define my faith. And I often do call it myself faith, because I think it is a kind of faith. You have to hold on to this thought that reason is capable of emancipating us somehow, or moving us beyond where we live and the constraints of our lives. And there is something that we can all do with other human beings as well in our social relations to change things. And And in that sense, also, there is a sense of the world to come that will be different from the world in which we live. And again, that's if you give a philosophical interpretation of Christianity and the afterworld and the afterlife and so on, it could be there could be a version of that that is some form of ethical living and ethical community. Kant has a lot to say on that in religion, in the limits of reason alone. So we can put that back for some other discussion. But yeah, I think you're right to call it a form of faith. And I'd be happy to defend that as well.
If you would like to subscribe to PPF Plus, where you can get ad-free listening of this episode and our whole archive, plus bonus episodes to accompany every series, just click on the link in our show description or go to ppfideas.com. Do also follow us on Twitter at ppfideas, on Instagram at ppfideas. There are video clips that come from this series too. Next time, I'm talking to Leia about Machiavelli and Republican ideas of freedom, then and now. This has been Past, Present, Future, brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.